Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Varma, today joined by Mahendra. The first news story we're going to be talking today is the opening day of the Mpanga Commission and the investigation into Lieutenant General Nkwanazi's allegations about the police minister. We're also going to be talking about how you design a city. We're also going to be talking about a mayoral candidate. And then if we have time, we're going to talk a little bit about some broken promises. So the Matlanga Commission, which was supposed to start on the 1st of September, I believe. So it's the 17th today, 2 weeks late, just over. But finally gotten underway. And we've had some sort of early testimony from Lieutenant General Nkwanazi, who was kind of the guy who kicked off of all of this by publicly announcing that he had evidence showing that the police minister and other senior members in the police system had links to organized crime. Nkwanazi said during this opening that it has been my aim to demonstrate that the criminal justice system has been subject to a continuous threat as well as sabotage. We believe it is at total risk of collapse if nothing is done. Urgent interventions are required to avert this outcome. I believe this commission will stand to play a very important role in order to help us prevent the total collapse of the justice system in our country. Judge Mtlanga said, if the allegations are proved to be true, this spells doom for South Africa's criminal justice system. A healthy justice system is key to the rule of law and, in turn, a functioning constitutional democracy. A criminal justice system is populated by corrupt functionaries. Many criminals, especially those holding positions of influence, will rarely, if ever, answer. At the center of any well-functioning democracy is a functioning criminal justice system. So, John, interesting politics going on around about this. I mean, firstly, do you agree with the announcements here that this is the criminal justice system hangs in the balance? I mean, that sounds pretty dire. But more than that, I mean, I'm still not entirely sure what to make of all the pieces here. Now, we're going to see more about what the evidence actually says, and I think that's going to be very important. You know, how strong is Lieutenant General Nkwanazi's evidence? He's laid some of it out publicly, but will it stand up to scrutiny? What's been interesting is the role of MK, who have played this very strange public role by trying in court to get the commission disbanded, but at the same time also praising Nkwanazi as a reliable whistleblower. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this is the political implications of the entire process, in the sense that I think there's almost unlimited scope for embarrassing revelations and discoveries to emerge out of the investigations of the Madlanga Commission. And that, I think, is really the big story here. You know, we're probably only scratching the surface right now in terms of the allegations that have been made so far and some of the revelations that we've heard so far, linking politicians and officials to criminals. I suspect that there's much truth to those connections that have been alleged so far, and that as the commission starts digging, it's going to find more and more to substantiate the suspicions. The problem really here is that we're seeing the ANC very much on the back foot, I think shaken in its confidence, with the feeling that it's losing its legitimacy and authority. And as a result of that, making a number of misjudgments, strategic blunders, one might say, like what President Ramaphosa did on Monday. I think that counts as a strategic blunder when he said that ANC councillors were right at the bottom in terms of delivery and should be looking to their political opposition, the DA, for guidance and inspiration. We also had the national dialogue, which I think was also a strategic misstep. And I think we're going to see more missteps as time goes on. And the Mdlanga Commission fits into that in the sense that it will provide more ammunition for the people who believe that the ANC has not only not delivered, but also has a lot to feel guilty about in terms of actual crime and corruption. So this really is a big story. We're still only at the beginning of it. I think this is going to continue rumbling on for quite a long time. We're going to see lots of revelations coming out of it. And I think none of it will be good for the ANC. Nick.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about what the sort of broader, you know, result of this commission will be. You know, our one big example of a similar thing is, of course, the Zondo Commission, which has been criticized by many, including me at the time, but many others, for that it was, you know, producing all of this noise and revealing all of these details, but ultimately there was no justice served. You know, the people implicated were not charged for the most part. The recommendations for how policy should be changed were not really taken seriously. It was just kind of ignored. However, you could make the argument that part of the reason the ANC's fortunes collapsed so badly in the 2024 election was partly because of that commission. It made life difficult for the ANC. It destroyed any vestiges of goodwill I think the party had. It also, you know, complicated the relationship with Jacob Zuma. While the Zondo Commission sat out there kind of, you know, embracing Zuma tightly in the tent and trying to keep him in the ANC was much harder, which perhaps encouraged him to go off and form MK. Do you think that's sort of maybe what the Matlanga Commission might end up being? I mean, look, it's early to say, but I suspect that if very important political figures are implicated, that it's we're still probably not going to see direct action from the president against them, but perhaps the public will be outraged and that will cause electoral consequences. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that the Matlanga Commission is far more dangerous to the ANC than the Zondo Commission was, in the sense that the Zondo Commission really could be positioned as investigating the failures of a previous administration, right? So it was right. Jacob Zuma was the bad guy and the people that he appointed were the bad guys. Cyril Ramaphosa as the good guy could say, you know, that's all in the past now. You know, we've gone through that. And it was possible, I think, for the ANC new administration to distance itself to some extent from the findings of the Zondo Commission. And that is leaving aside the fact that there haven't been, you know, proper consequences for it. But it was a bit more arm's length and therefore a bit safer. But the Matlanga Commission is investigating serving politicians like and officials, like people who are currently in office, in power, running the show. And so I think it's far more dangerous to the ANC and to the government as well than the Zondo Commission was. Plus, also, the Matlanga Commission is operating in a time when the ANC is far weaker than it was at the time of the Zondo Commission. So for the ANC to be able to squash findings or through bluster, you know, fight its way out of embarrassing allegations is going to be more difficult now. Yes, exactly.
I mean, the fact that Senator Matuna was suspended, I think, does speak to that, that, you know, we've already seen that this is pretty serious stuff. And Mkhwanazi has already developed sort of this kind of reputation that South Africans love to attach to our various kind of whistleblower, lone whistleblower figures. You know, Thuli Madonsela got this for a while. Mm-hmm. I think at the beginning of the arms deal, I think Patricia de Lille got this sort of thing as well, because she made, you know, encouraged some of the investigations into that. You know, we have this habit in South Africa of kind of picking up these characters who have you know, said no to corruption or exposed corruption, and then becoming sort of folk heroes. It normally doesn't seem to end that well.
That's true.
The people involved.
And I think also, like, one thing that you're probably going to start exploring, or we are going to start exploring on The Daily Friend, is the question of Cyril Ramaphosa's own position. You know, so for a long time, he's been the vote getter for the ANC and, you know, the savior of the ANC, the representative of the good ANC fighting back against the bad ANC. But he's now, I think, very rapidly weakening. You know, he's nearing the end of his final term. His popularity is not what it once was. Allegations about crime and corruption are hitting closer to home. Plus, he's making these strategic mistakes like the one on Monday, plus also the national dialogue. So I think President Ramaphosa himself is going to find himself in increasingly hot water as time goes on and as we approach the various elections that lie in the future.
It's sort of a truth across democracies all over the world that presidents in their second term towards kind of the end of their time in office, it never goes as well as it did in the beginning. And there are very few political leaders who truly leave office on a high note. And it seems that is going to be no exception for President Ramaphosa. But, you know, the question does remain, John, you know, what if Paul Mashatile simply tries to pull the Zondo Commission trick with the Matlanga Commission? Mm-hmm. Look, all the evils that were exposed, where I am the new broom, even though I was pretty present. But I guess, you know, Ramaphosa got away with that one. So
absolutely.
I'm the new Rome, and I'm taking the party back to its roots or something, and we're no longer going to be evil sellouts siding with the criminals and also the evil neo-reactionaries and the DA or whatever the
exactly. Do you think that would be a nice platform? Yeah, that would be a nice platform for 2027, right? If you take that as your campaign platform. We're distancing ourselves from the terrible ANC that was discovered to be corrupt by the Madlanga Commission. We're launching ourselves into a new era, unburdened by the past. And I forget how the rest of that slogan goes.
Unburdened by what has been.
Unburdened by what has been. There we go. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
All right. We shall have to see what exactly comes out of all this. I will be pleasantly surprised if the sort of 3-month deadline for the initial report is met. I suspect that this is, you know, if the commission couldn't start on time, I'm skeptical the report will come out on time. But we shall have to wait and see. Okay, let's move on to something quite different. Something that's of interest to me that always seems to evoke a surprising amount of passion from people is how you design cities, how do you design places that people live. There are those who believe that you need walkable cities in order to have a good life, and that basically everything must be walkable from your home, everything from healthcare to education to entertainment to even possibly work. And there are others who believe that small walkable cities and high density buildings are basically a way of crushing the human spirit and soul and putting us all into pods so that we can be fed, Soylent Green and insects and all that sort of thing. It's with that in mind that I see Johannesburg has ranked the least walkable city in the world in 2025, placing last in a global study of 90 urban areas conducted by a group called Compare the Market. And the city scored 18.3 out of 100. Some of the other cities that performed sort of low on the rankings: Dallas, 88th place; Houston, 87th place. I've been to Houston and I can confirm it's not very easy to walk around.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Scoring highly, Prague in the Czech Republic, Vienna in Austria, Tokyo in Japan, scoring in the 60s. In the sort of top places, Poland, Wrocław, and London also scored highly. So it does seem like there's a strong bias here towards a lot of European cities, and with, you know, and then also Tokyo, and I'm sure there's probably some other Japanese cities on the list there. Mm-hmm. But what does it say about Johannesburg that we ranked last on this list? One of the downsides, I guess, is that lots of South Africans can't afford cars. So this is a real problem, is that, you know, your transport costs are very high. It's the thing poor South Africans are always talking about or having to deal with, is just incredible costs of transport. People who work as construction workers or domestic workers or whatever, where work is far from where they live, are just spending huge percentages of their income on simply just getting to work. So, John, what's your thoughts on this? I mean, you know, is this a problem that we can actually fix in Johannesburg? And is it a problem we necessarily want to fix? Or what are your thoughts? Mm.
I think there are some aspects you can fix and others that you can't. For this ranking, apparently, they also included whether it rains a lot or not. So a walkable city is one that doesn't get that much rain. So Tokyo gets some minus points because it rains more than in Johannesburg. But it is disappointing to see Johannesburg, my hometown, ranked so lowly. I'd much prefer to be further up in the rankings, but I recognize the problems. I wonder how many of our viewers who are in Johannesburg actually walk in Johannesburg. I assume that is not very many, but I do walk in the suburbs. That's fine, but it's not really a useful way, I think, for getting things done in the sense of, you know, getting to work or doing your shopping. For that, you do need motorized transport. And I think that aspect is not so easy to fix, right? It's a sprawling city, which is something it has in common with places like Houston and Dallas and a couple of other places as well, which means that distances are large. And the question you have to ask, of course, then, is there a trade-off? Like, do you get any benefit in exchange for having long traveling distances and urban sprawl? And yes, you do get some benefits, which is that usually properties are larger and people then have more space on their own property. It's not high density living like it would be in Tokyo, for example. And that is something that some people like.
Standalone houses.
Yeah, standalone houses, exactly, on stands. And the price for that you pay for that is that you need a car to get around or other form of motorized transport, be it a taxi or a train or whatever it is. That is the price you pay. One of the factors I think that also got Johannesburg marked down, and that is something that can be addressed and should be addressed, is safety, right? So Johannesburg
Right, that's
is,
the
I
big
think,
one.
both for these, yeah, both for reasons of crime, but also for reasons of urban architecture, not a good city for walking. The
Yes.
sidewalks are not maintained. Often there aren't even sidewalks. The drivers are not considerate of pedestrians. Road crossings are not well marked. Zebra crossings are not respected. Traffic lights are not respected. So it's dangerous to be a pedestrian in Johannesburg, from a traffic point of view. But of course, it's also dangerous from a crime point of view. And those are certainly two things that could be addressed. Maybe just one final point. In that ranking, I think was also included proximity to green spaces. And I think there Johannesburg presents a bit of a mixed picture depending on which part of the city you're in,
Yeah.
because it is also sometimes described as the world's biggest urban forest or the world's biggest artificial forest. So there is a lot of greenery about, and there are parks scattered throughout the city, but maybe not in all areas equally. And so I think that would be
Yeah.
something that should be done as the city continues growing, is to make sure that parks and green spaces are kept available for nearby residents to use.
Yeah, I'm generally of the view that you kind of need a bit of a mix, right? I think there's a lot of value in standalone houses. Personally, it's what I prefer. But I also think that there should be safe, good quality, high density housing that is close to stuff. There are certain people who prefer that lifestyle. And that can really synergize well with kind of particularly young professionals, people who, enjoy life out in the town, that kind of thing. Also it would be nice for poorer people to be able to have housing that was actually closer to where, the jobs are. But to do all of these things, you need a city that works in its most basic ways. For example, you need a public transport system of some quality. You need safety is the most important one. You need also bylaw enforcement, right? If you have a big stack of flats and it just turns into urban decay and the people selling drugs outside and just kind of general chaos, it's never going to work. You're just going to create slums. I think we shouldn't be too upset about getting such a low ranking on a walkability study, but I think it does kind of point us in what we might gain actually from improving the governance of our cities. There's something to be said about having a walkable city, even if it's not right for everyone, and it certainly isn't right for everyone.
Maybe just one more point there, Nicholas, is that for all of its lack of walkability, there's huge numbers of people walking in Johannesburg. So it's not like,
Yes.
the streets are bare of pedestrians. There are very many people
Right.
walking, not by choice, I think,
Yeah,
mostly
but
because
the
they have
result of
to.
poverty. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so that reflects again on economic growth and prosperity and the means to do something. Plus, it also says that if you've got so many people walking, the least you can do is to create the conditions to make the walking safe, and make it pleasant if possible. So have proper sidewalks, make sure that motorists respect pedestrians, et cetera, et cetera. So it's we're letting the pedestrians down in quite a number of ways in Johannesburg.
Yes. But I think this does also raise the sort of question of what comes after you've actually fixed the city's basic systems. If you actually fix Joburg's basic, municipal services, you then have to think about what your planning system is. And that's when questions like this start to become really important. I tend to be some kind of anarchic, insane libertarian on the question of planning. There are very many people who get very upset by that sort of stuff. But I think these are hopefully future battles we will be fighting in South Africa's political space. We're not there yet because we can't get the garbage picked up or the road potholes filled, but this is sort of the next frontier in our politics, with any luck. Okay. Next story. In a live stream on Facebook this week, Patriotic Alliance leader Gayton McKenzie announced that Kenny Kunene would be the party's mayoral candidate for Joburg. Now, this is a little bit awkward because Kenny Kunene was suspended when he was found at murder suspect Katiso Molefe's house. When Molefe was arrested, which is a bit awkward to be hanging out as a major political leader alongside someone who's just being arrested for murder. So the PA suspended him as deputy leader of the party and said that they would sort out whether he was guilty of any improper conduct. That has not concluded yet, that inquiry. However, the party says it's pretty sure that it's going to clear him anyway. And if it finds against him, he'll step down. He's already promised that he'll step down as mayoral candidate. Now, there's the entire question of whether there really was any kind of serious inquiry, considering the party seems so sure that they're going to appoint him as their mayoral candidate. But the other question, just politically speaking, is Kinikunene was running the Johannesburg Roads Agency, was the MMC for roads in Johannesburg, I believe. I don't know if that's a great person you want to be putting up as your mayoral candidate for Joburg. I mean, the number two thing on the list that Joburg is complaining about after water shortages is almost always potholes. And, this is the guy who is, associated politically most closely with those. Am I wrong, John? What's going on here?
Yeah, I think we, in a sense, I think we're falling into the trap of doing what the PA wants us to do, right? So the PA is very good at getting itself into the media and getting itself talked about. And one way to do that in this situation is to find somebody whose reputation is somewhat compromised, like Kenny Konene is currently, declaring him to be the mayoral candidate without need or necessity far in advance of the election. And the effect of that is to get people like us talking about that decision. That puts the PA back in the spotlight. It gets them media coverage. It raises their relevance. And I think it will probably help them electorally, just to be visible. In terms of the seriousness of the proposal, I don't think it is serious. In South Africa, we don't really elect mayors directly. So appointing a mayoral candidate isn't like putting up a candidate for people to vote for. It's more the face of a campaign for a party. And so really this declaration of candidacy, I think, is aimed at boosting the visibility of the party rather than the candidate. And neither you nor I will be much surprised if it turns out that 3 months from now, Kenny Konene's candidacy is withdrawn and somebody else is appointed in his place. Anything could happen. I don't think that this is meant seriously.
As we all know, a Facebook live stream is the most official platform to launch one's political candidacies. So 2 points on this. One is, I think that perhaps oversells the degree to which publicity is good. I think this is also perhaps, I agree that this is the PA's kind of way of engaging with politics, but not all publicity is good publicity. At the end of the day, you have to inspire a certain something in people. And there are some people who think that Kenny Kunene is cool. I just don't know whether it's that big a group of people, if it's the people that the PA needs to convince to come vote for them. If all publicity was good publicity, and notoriety and getting in the media was the only thing that mattered, Jacob Zuma and Julius Malema would be running the government now with a majority, I think, because, they are in many ways the most, most South Africans have a very strong opinion on those two, whether it is for good or for ill. And generally speaking, it's for ill. So yeah, I think also just that association with running a part of Joburg that particularly irritates a lot of people is not going to go down too well. I also think that that this is the kind of the problem that the PA does have, is that they don't have sort of structures. This idea of mayoral candidates, I'm pretty sure, is an innovation of the DA in South Africa. They would put up a person on their face, and it you're completely correct in a technical sense. We don't vote for mayoral candidates, but what we do is, particularly in modern politics, is people like to kind of get caught up in personalities, particularly in the age of social media. They want to see the face of the politician who is going to actually be running the city. And so that's why Jordan Hill Lewis is putting himself in every video. That's why, Gaden McKenzie puts himself in all those things when he was briefly the mayor in the Western Cape. You do want to have a strong face out for the party there. And because the PA doesn't have structures, as far as I can tell, because it just seems to be kind of decided upon by Gate McKenzie as to who's going to be the candidate for where, this is kind of the result that you get, is that you don't get the sort of internal contestation that can produce a stronger candidate. You get sort of anointment. And in the short term, that can help you because it keeps you quite stable, right? There isn't a lot of faction fighting. But the downside is that you kind of limit your room to grow. I don't know what your thoughts are on all that.
No, I think you're right. So as I said, this doesn't have the feeling of eternity about it. So I think this decision might be rescinded or changed or chopped around.
But if it can be decided with the wave of a hand, it can be taken away with the wave of a hand.
Yes. Exactly. So it's a bit, I think, a bit of a gimmick. You find a recognizable face, a recognizable name with a bit of brand equity attached to it, and then you use that. I don't think it's much more complicated than that. I think not all publicity is good publicity. That's true. But if you're a small party, you need to get into the news, you need to get into the headlines, you need to get people talking about you. And I suspect that there are PA voters who will not be put off by this at all. They'll say, Kenny Konene was accused on the basis of spurious evidence. He has actually done nothing wrong. He's behaved very honorably by agreeing to be suspended or by stepping back while he's investigated. And there's nothing wrong with him, standing as mayoral candidate in the meantime. It's still a long way to go to the elections. And by then, we're sure he's going to be cleared. So it's absolutely fine. But having just spoken about walkable cities and having transport on our minds, I think many Johannesburgers are going to be reluctant to put their cross next to Mr. Konene's name.
All right. Very last story. Just going to talk about this one briefly. In 2019, in his State of the Nation address, President Cyril Ramaphosa announced that we were going to get digital workbooks and textbooks on tablet devices in every classroom in the country. This was, I think this was the same speech with the smart cities and all of the incredible promises that that we got out of Ramaphosa when his political capital was vast and his stock was riding high. It will not surprise people that this has not really been accomplished. So doing a quick search, it seems like there's about 26,000-ish schools in South Africa. 16,000 state schools have yet to be connected to the internet by mobile network operators. And we are not even vaguely close to the president's promise 6 years ago of rolling out this vast digital infrastructure. I mean, we kind of knew it at the time, but it is sort of depressing. There's this comment here in the story that the spokesperson speaking to the parliamentary committee on this issue said that that this would have cost 30 billion rand in order to do this digitization project. And government, unfortunately, did not have that kind of money. Your thoughts, John?
Yeah, I think when we spoke before the show, we said this is an example of broken promises, and that's kind of the first thing that sticks out. What makes the story a tiny bit unusual is that there was a deadline or a time set where the president said within 6 years, all the schools will be connected. And because he did that, now that 6 years have passed, we can measure that and say, okay, like, did that happen? No. So the promise was not delivered on. And I'm sure there's a myriad of other promises, some with deadlines, some without, that have not been kept. And the sort of secondary implication of this is that when the president accuses ANC councillors of not performing and not delivering, that finger is pointing right back at him, because those councillors might well say, well, you blame us, but look at yourself. You made a promise in 2019. You were meant to do this thing and you haven't done it. So why are you blaming us? You're the problem, or you're as much the problem as we are, and stop blaming us. So it creates this risk of internal fighting within the ANC, where people start trying to shift the blame onto each other, which doesn't really help with delivery or performance or getting vote share back up. So it's not a great development for the ANC or for the president. One further implication that I think is worth pointing out here is that you do have to make, you have to prioritize in making political decisions. And so the government has spent a lot of time now on creating things like black industrialist programs, like punting transformation, like punting localization. So all of these policies come with a price tag attached, which runs into the billions of rands. And the government has prioritized those things over connecting schools to the internet. And it's worth just reminding ourselves that this is what happens, right? You have to make a political choice. And much as you want to deny it, there is a trade-off. And when you do one thing, there's another thing you can't do. And sometimes people are going to call you out on that. And they'll say, okay, you've chosen to do this one thing, black industrialists, but you've accepted that you're not able to educate school kids as a result. Was that a good choice? And I think if this was put to voters, and especially to parents, of course, they'd say, this is a terrible choice. You know, the black industrialists is a small group of people, you know, 50, 100, 1,000, who are having money shoveled down their throats to, you know, do some sort of business entrepreneurship thing that has unclear results and doesn't generate new tax revenue, doesn't really work. But our kids still don't have internet at the school. Was that a good choice? And I think voters will say that was not a good choice. And that is something the ANC is going to be confronted with, especially on this topic of, as we call it at the IRR, fake transformation, which is focusing on racial transformation of the economy and of society at the expense of real transformation, which is a growing economy, higher investment, and better educated school children. And so really, the focus should be on real transformation versus fake transformation. The ANC represents fake transformation and still clings to it. If it wants to survive, it does have to let go of that. Nick.
Yeah, once again, a project like the Black Industrialists, while it's purported to help Black South Africans, as you say, the consequences of making that choice over other ones is that rather than having an entire generation of Black South Africans with access to the latest in terms of educational attainment and technologies, we're going to make a few more millionaires and billionaires, which for a party that sort of has at times described itself as kind of socialist, communist, of the left, it's a little bit odd.
It is a bit odd.
Supposed to be, you know, fighting for the workers and the ordinary people. Was quite literally shoveling money to the capitalist fat cats here, which is bonkers. But anyway, thank you very much, John, and thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found today's show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.